This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 18, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Israelis and Palestinians slowly wade into a shaky ceasefire. Teachers in Chile end a three-day strike with calls for meaningful education reform. And following massive flooding in Iowa, levees continue to break along the Mississippi River downstream. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. President Bush today called on Congress to lift the federal ban on offshore drilling and open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil companies. Bush says the move would help to alleviate high gas prices and the domestic dependence on foreign oil. Republican presidential candidate John McCain, who opposes opening ANWR to drilling, told an audience in Houston yesterday that he supports reversing the 27-year ban on offshore drilling. The push for offshore drilling and exploration in the protected Arctic Reserve comes as the country's strategic petroleum reserve is filled to 97% capacity. The European Parliament has voted in legally binding targets for the recycling of waste by all member states. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Europe generates nearly 2 billion tons of waste a year. That's an average of 3.5 tons a person. But under the new rules, 50% of waste from households and 70% of hazardous materials are to be recycled by 2020. Those member states that don't comply could face legal action. In order to achieve these targets, member states will need to introduce domestic legislation. For example, more citizens will be required to separate their household rubbish for specific collections. Companies will face tighter inspections on waste disposal, and more facilities will have to be provided. However, Green MEPs have criticised the lack of binding rules for manufacturing and industrial waste. They're also disappointed that EU states couldn't agree on waste prevention targets. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The global credit crunch may be causing economic downturns worldwide, but one sector has shown remarkable growth, that of renewable energy markets. Francesca Rhiannon has more on the rise of these so-called green-collar jobs.
Record-high oil prices are helping to fuel a worldwide push towards renewable energy technologies, so much so that green-collar jobs have increased by about 20% in the UK in the last year, according to environmental job recruiter Acre Resources. The money is good, too, ranging from more than $60,000 to $120,000 in annual pay. Driving the industry are corporations seeking to make good on their environmental commitments, and banks seeking a safe haven for their cash are pouring into renewable energy investments. Information technology firms Intel, IBM, and HP have all recently announced solar cell projects. And Morgan Stanley recently closed a $20 million deal for a stake in a UK-based solar energy company. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Francesca Rhiannon of Corporate Watchdog Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts.
NATO troops and Afghan security forces have launched a major offensive in the area around the southern Afghan city of Kandahar. At least 24 people have reportedly died in the operation, a majority of those being suspected Taliban insurgents killed in a single airstrike. Civilians in the area have been warned to stay inside. Kandahar is the city where the Taliban first emerged as a political force in Afghanistan. In other news, Iraqi negotiators have decided to resume talks on a long-term security treaty with the United States after the Bush administration dropped its demand that U.S. private contractors receive immunity from prosecution. The treaty has been a contentious issue for Iraqi lawmakers, who will have little to no influence on the agreement. Just last Friday, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told reporters in Jordan that the negotiations had reached a dead end, but al-Maliki has since backtracked. The security treaty calls for a long-term U.S. military presence in Iraq, regardless of who is in the White House. Negotiations are set to end in late July, although it is unclear if the two sides will be able to make their target deadline. And finally, President Bush's approval rating has sunk to a new low. New data from the Harris Interactive Polling Agency shows that only 24% of Americans surveyed think the president is doing a good job. Vice President Dick Cheney fared even worse in the court of public opinion with an 18% approval rating. And the lowest ratings of all went to the Democrat-controlled Congress, with a full 83% of respondents giving a negative opinion. Overall, 4 out of 5 surveyed said the country is on the wrong track. The biggest concerns cited by respondents were the economy, the war, gas prices, and health care. Harris Interactive describes the poll results as an indication of Americans' quote, foul political mood. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Levees are breaking all along the North Mississippi as floodwaters flow south from Iowa. The Army Corps of Engineers says 20 levees have already failed, and they are predicting that as many as 30 more, most near small towns, are in danger of breaching or being overtaken by the rising waters. Pat Slattery is with the National Weather Service's Central Region Office.
Right now, a lot of the attention is on the Mississippi River from about Iowa state line on down south of St. Louis. As the water runs downstream and is now starting to build considerably in the Mississippi River channel. There are still some problems within the particular states and with the Mississippi tributaries. For instance, there was a levee failure in Iowa yesterday that inundated something like 5,000 acres of farm ground and communities that had been protected by a levee.
Communities along the river are frantically sandbagging the banks. The Illinois governor has called up the state's National Guard and has enlisted the help of inmates. But while the rising water itself is an issue, the impact of what's in the water may linger for years. Because the flooded areas are largely agricultural, fertilizers and pesticides are potentially running off at high rates as the water rushes over fields. In more urban areas, the waters are causing sewer overflows and have compromised businesses like gas stations where pollutants are concentrated. Officials are telling residents to stay out of the water and are preventing some from returning home. The Red Cross, despite financial troubles, has set up emergency shelters across the region. But there is a bit of good news. Slattery says any flooding south of St. Louis will be relatively mild because the Mississippi River becomes wider and deeper, capable of handling more flow. Most communities will see moderate flood levels.
Now, there could be some changes in those levels depending on rain, especially if there was very heavy rain. But as it looks right now for the next few days, there is not significant rainfall expected in that area at the moment. And our forecasters have been able to give warning if to the public and to water managers and emergency management agencies in the various states that, okay, these storms are coming. Generally, we're be able to tell them that 4 and 5 days in advance, which at least gives them some time to prepare for what's coming.
President Bush is scheduled to tour the damage in Iowa tomorrow, about a week after flooding began. Bush says his administration is setting up a housing task force to aid those who lose their homes during the floods. Officials predict the price tag for the disaster will top $1.5 billion. Today, Palestinians and Israel approved an Egyptian-mediated ceasefire, which will go into effect tomorrow morning. But an Israeli defense official has stressed that it is not a peace treaty and that Israel will continue to prepare for military action. And even though Hamas officials have publicly stressed their commitment to the ceasefire, Palestinians are cautious about the sustainability of the truce. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more from Gaza City.
As Palestinians and Israel agree to a Cairo-mediated ceasefire announcement, only the actions of both sides on the ground will determine whether any truce can be sustained. The ruling Hamas party, which has represented the 12 Palestinian factions to the truce talks in Cairo recently, says that the ceasefire will first be applied for a period of 6 months in Gaza, in which Israel will commit to reopening the border crossings gradually, as talks over the release of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit will be resumed simultaneously. Asked whether his party will help such a truce deal hold, Mohammed al-Baba, a political leader of the Popular Resistance Committees, one of the 3 groups holding Shalit, told Afasaran that the ball is now in the Israeli court.
في معبر رفح وفي المعابر الإسرائيلية الأخرى.
The fate of the Rafah crossing terminal and that of other crossings are still in the hands of Israel. At any rate, we won't obstruct the truce and the lifting of the blockade enforcing our people. Yet we will be watching very closely the Israelis' reopening of such crossings. So if such a truce will lead to lifting the siege, we will of course do our best to ensure its implementation.
Israel's approval of the Cairo announcement yesterday was based on two previous Israeli conditions: achieving a progress on negotiations over the release of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit and halt of arms smuggling from Egypt into Gaza. Amir Ibrahim is a Gaza political analyst on Israeli affairs, explains why Israel accepted the deal. فإسرائيل تراعي في هذا القبول المشروط أنه
The Israeli approval of this truce can be attributed first to the fact that any Israeli attack will definitely lead to Shalit's death, and second, because the military option for Israel will have many repercussions, especially after the last Israeli war on
Lebanon.
The possibility of human casualties and failure of such a large planned military offensive will overshadow the political future of both Olmert and Barak, who are nearing elections.
In Gaza, the Palestinian public expressed doubt over the sustainability of a ceasefire. Rana is a 22-year-old female university student.
We always hear that, but so far, we don't realize anything implemented on the ground. Just this morning, I heard about rocket fire. However, we hope to see calm, yet I doubt this, and I am pessimistic because every time we hope the situation will change, we observe the opposite. Overall, I look forward to an improvement in the situation.
In April, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza submitted a ceasefire proposal to Egyptian mediators, stipulating a lift of the Israeli siege and a halt to military attacks on Gaza, in return for assurance that homemade rocket fire would be stopped. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Podcasts and transcripts of Free Speech Radio News can be found online at www.fsrn.org. Their listeners can also comment on the day's stories and participate in discussion forums. That's online at fsrn.org. Teachers in Chile on Wednesday ended a three-day strike in opposition to an education reform bill currently being debated in Congress. The teachers argue the general education law does nothing to protect public education and will hurt low-income students. The president of Chile's Teachers Association estimates that 15,000 teachers and students marched in solidarity. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón explains.
The teachers called the strike for this week to coincide with a vote in Congress of a new education bill that aims to reform a faulty education system inherited from the military regime. The current education system favors private education and private education funded with public funds, all in competition for students with the public education system. The public system has lost its importance. According to Ministry of Education figures, 47% of all students attend public schools. The rest attend private schools or private schools that receive government funding. Striking teachers are demanding the education bill in Congress be withdrawn and redrafted with the participation of all those involved in the education system. Jaime Gallardo, the president of the teachers' union, explains why they are demanding that the proposed legislation be withdrawn.
We want new language that takes into account the view of the majority, because when we examine this bill clause by clause, we see ideas and the interests of those who want to privatize, introduce market forces, introduce vouchers to education. When we participated in the Presidential Election Commission, that group made proposals that we supported, but unfortunately the legislation sent to Congress ignored those proposals.
This school year, students have staged strikes and demonstrations against the proposed legislation. Teachers are now spearheading the opposition to the bill. This proposed bill is the outcome of massive demonstrations in 2006 that led to the creation of the Presidential Education Commission on Education. That body, made up of groups linked to the education system, made proposals that teachers and students say were ignored. They say the bill quashes the concept of public education in favor of private education funded by the state. Students' unions met this weekend to strategize, and they agreed to support the teachers' call for a strike. Student spokesperson Jose Ancalao explains.
The Students' Assembly decided to continue with our mobilizations until the current bill is withdrawn and a new piece of legislation is drafted. We are joining in with the teachers and other social organizations. We want a large movement so that the government realizes that it's not only the students involved, but also the majority of the people. We call on everybody to take over public spaces so that the government wakes up to the fact that students are fighting for a better education.
The center-left government proposed two amendments to the bill with language that places public education at its core. But the right-wing opposition charges the changes go against the spirit of the old party agreement signed in early March. Those in support to the bill also say the change in language goes against parental choice when selecting a school for their children. Teachers say it is that concept of choice in favor of private education paid with public funds that is killing public education and creating a segmented class-based system. Currently, both private elite and private schools that receive state fundings can choose their students, dumping problem children onto the public system. Those who can pay can send their children to elite private schools, the middle class to private schools that receive public funds, and the working poor are left with no choice but to be stuck in underfunded public schools. Despite the opposition from students and teachers, the Minister of Education, Monica Jimenez, had this to say to their demands.
They are asking for something that is impossible. They know their demands are impossible. The bill will not be withdrawn. The will of the president is for this legislation to stay in Congress. We have accepted only two specific changes on public education language. The legislative debate will continue its course until legislators agree. This bill has to continue debate. Teachers and students want something from this bill they cannot have. This legislation is a framework bill, which is a great leap forward.
The current Education Act allows for private schools to receive state funding, while public education is managed by municipal governments that lack the tools to do so. Education outcomes show that children from elite schools have better results. Those that attend private schools with state funding do not do that much better when compared with public schools that show usually lower results. That is the argument teachers and students make, that those private institutions that receive state funding should be done away with and all public funding be transferred to public schools. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
A group of intellectuals and activists in India are in the midst of a 10-day fast to protest the continued detention of physician and prominent human rights activist Dr. Binayak Sen. Indian police arrested Sen more than a year ago, charging him with sedition and having unlawful contact with Maoist insurgents. He denies the allegations. Protesters in India are demanding his immediate and unconditional release. Bismillah Jilani has more.
Dr. Binayak Sen is currently in a prison in the Indian state of Chhattisgarh. The government accuses him of having links with the Maoist insurgents. Since his imprisonment, Dr. Sen has received support and recognition around the world. In May 2008, he was awarded the Jonathan Mann Award for Global Health and Human Rights and invited to Washington, D.C. to receive the honor. Appeals by a group of 22 Nobel laureates and the Global Health Council failed to move the Indian government to allow Binayak Sen receive the award personally. Alina Sen, Binayak Sen's wife, received the award on his behalf. She is disappointed at the government's response.
There should have been acknowledgement. There should have been pride and happiness. And I'm sure many people feel it. But this just shows that the government is totally disconnected from the reality. I am disappointed.
I'm disappointed. 58-year-old Binayak Sen is known for his selfless devotion in serving some of India's most impoverished communities. He has been working for more than 2 decades to improve health care and living conditions of the tribal people and mine workers in the Indian state of Chhattisgarh. His arrest and continued detention has provoked outrage across the country. Rajendra Sachar, civil liberty activist and former Chief Justice of Delhi High Court, says it's a shame for Indian democracy.
These things have no business to happen in a democracy. This is a matter of shame. What is horrifying is his continued detention, and we are rather disappointed that the central government is not putting pressure on the state government to withdraw the case, because it is a totally false case.
Totally a false case.
Chhattisgarh is among the few Indian states where the Maoist militants have a strong presence. The Maoists, also known as the Naxalites, claim to be fighting for the rights of landless farmers and rural poor. Binayak Sen was an outspoken critic of the government for violating human rights in the name of fighting insurgency. He has brought to light several such violations committed by Salwa Judom, a group of tribals armed and funded by the government to fight the Maoists. Activists believe this is the reason Sen is being targeted. K.G. Kannabiran is national president of the People's Union for Civil Liberties.
The main reason is he has been condemning human rights violations which are taking place in that area on account of Mao's presence.
Kannabiran says the space for human rights activism is increasingly shrinking, and in the absence of any guarantees of protection, the activists continue to face arbitrary detentions.
All human rights violations take place
in that space, and that is thievery terrain in which human rights activists work. And every time the human rights activist works in this terrain, he is implicated in a case. These are matters which are really frightening. So there is a need that an international public opinion should really enter into this arena and say what is the role of a defender of human rights. What are the protections he has?
Protests against Sen's detention are mounting all over the world. The Free Binayak Sen campaign, launched by a coalition of various individuals and groups, has now participation from 31 countries. The campaigners have been writing petitions, sending faxes and emails to the Indian Prime Minister, and organizing demonstrations and music concerts to raise the issue. A number of them have begun a 10-day fast demanding unconditional release of Binayak Sen. They are also demanding repeal of the stringent law Sen has been booked under. Sudha Bhardwaj, a member of the lawyers' collective representing Sen, says the Chhattisgarh Public Security Act treats dissent as a crime.
This is an act in which the definition of unlawful activity is so wide as to cover any kind of democratic dissent, which means that there is a scope for the widespread misuse of this act. And people like Dr. Binayak Sen, who are civil liberties activists and whose work is to help people in prison and even to provide legal aid, he was very much within the legitimate ambit of his activities, but that is being thought to be criminalized.
The response this campaign has met with clearly shows that although the government has succeeded in removing Binayak Sen from public activity, it has not been able to wipe him out of public consciousness and memory. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Teachers who express their opinions on controversial social issues can find themselves in a lot of trouble, whether it be evolution versus creationism, war versus peace, gay rights, or their personal political leanings. A teacher has limited freedom of speech. Last year, a federal court of appeals ruled that a teacher's words are the commodity she sells to an employer in exchange for her salary. The issue has once again reared its head in South Los Angeles. Protests continue over the effective termination of an alleged Afrocentric teacher. Officials say although Catherine Sanchez is allowed to teach the autobiography of Malcolm X, the way she teaches the topic is tantamount to brainwashing. Dan Fritz reports from KPFK in Los Angeles.
In South Los Angeles, a second-year English teacher at Jordan High School, Karen Salazar, makes efforts to reach her students through creative exercises that aim to stimulate their own critical thinking about political topics. She draws heavily from current events that interest them. She also uses materials that highlight the historical struggle of people of color in this country.
I had students do a cross-sectional analysis of the Gina Six case with the Emmett Till case, and I had them write poetic responses to their analyses in the form of sonnets, and the administrator who observed me claimed that I was creating militancy within my students, and he couldn't quite explain how sonnets translated into militancy.
A few months after this observation, Salazar was informed of her termination at the end of the 2007-2008 school year. She contacted her union representative at the United Teachers of Los Angeles. Mark Taylor is the union chair for the South Los Angeles area. Taylor contacted district officials to get an explanation for Salazar's termination. Taylor was informed by Salazar's superintendent supervisor that Jordan High School's principal accused Salazar of being, quote, Afrocentric, brainwashing the kids, and being anti-Semitic.
It was the principal that escalated this to, she's Afrocentric because of the way she taught the Malcolm X speech, that she was brainwashing the kids, and that there was two other instances of, too much black culture or something in the classroom. And the anti-Semitic remark, they wouldn't clear up. Only thing Miss Salazar could come up with was, hey, I have a PLO poster on my wall, along with lots of other kinds of interesting and controversial posters to get my kids to think about the world.
Jordan High Assistant Principal Dean Whitman denied that the administration ever mentioned Afrocentrism as a problem with Salazar's teaching. According to Salazar and Taylor, the school stated that they had to let someone go due to budgetary constraints. But as a second-year teacher, Salazar has seniority over a handful of first-year teachers.
Since then, the principal has now changed again what he said. He's denying that he ever even said that I was Afrocentric. He's saying that now what he's claiming is that I'm not teaching standards, that I am failing to incorporate the culturally relevant curriculum that I bring with a standards-based curriculum. The lead teacher from my academy did a survey of the teachers. The average number of observations that teachers received this year was 2.
LAUSD Deputy Ramon Cortinas claims Salazar is welcome to teach Malcolm X and use her discretion towards culturally relevant teaching. However, she cannot vary from the standards.
Teachers have responsibility to cover the standards that are covered on the California State Assessment. I've made it very clear when she said she was prohibited from using Malcolm X, she is not.
In response, Salazar says she has received a total of between 15 and 17 informal observations, each ending with a write-up that gave her satisfactory marks for using approved curriculum. According to Salazar, the real issue was how she helped students organize on campus. The Watts Student Union issued a series of demands to school officials last year, demanding cultural studies classes and post-traumatic stress days for the students to deal with difficult personal issues away from school without needing a doctor's note to avoid being counted as truant. Concurrently, the Los Angeles Times published a poll of 8 inner-city high schools, including high number of students from Jordan High School, which asked them what inner-city students need in order to be successful. The Jordan High School students cited a lack of support from the school and a depressive environment. Karen Salazar was the faculty sponsor for the student groups that wanted to address these issues.
The administration was embarrassed that students were calling them out on their lack of being able to support students and meeting their basic educational needs, much less human rights. And so I believe that this is in retaliation of my support for student organizing and students' efforts to make concrete changes at the school.
Last week, more than a dozen teachers at Jordan High School submitted their resignation or transfer request, citing administration oppression, in support of Karen Salazar being rehired for next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dan Fritz.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.